Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, here we are, episode number 86. It's Saturday, October 31st. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. I am recording this show on Halloween, and things are looking frightening. And by the time you hear this, they'll probably be even more frightening. In fact, things are looking downright crappy. Case in point, our poopy surveillance system. I just got this in today, on Saturday, a little unusual. I've never gotten this kind of press release from the Toledo Lucas County Health Department, but here it is. Monitoring of community wastewater detects elevated levels of COVID-19 in Lucas County. Currently, sampling is occurring in the Lucas County Water Resource Recovery Facility, Oregon Wastewater Treatment Plant, and the Toledo Bay View Park Wastewater Treatment Plant. In the most recent data, Toledo Bay Park in Oregon showed a marked increase in COVID-19 fragments. However, the Lucas County Water Resource Recovery Facility plant now has significant increase in fragments of 153% from testing done on October 18th to testing done on October 26th. Increases of fragments may be an early indicator that cases of COVID-19 in the community may intensify for residents in the plant service area, including Holland, Maumee, Waterville, White House, and other limited portions of unincorporated Lucas County. Well, like much of the country, Lucas County has been surrounded by higher cases of COVID-19 recently. It seems to be moving from rural areas back to urban areas, and this seems to be showing that to be the case locally. Okay, well, let's get on with the local update. Lucas County average daily cases increased from an average daily rate of 55 new cases to 78 new cases. This is an over 40% increase in the last week. Cases seem to be skyrocketing all over the country, in Ohio, and Lucas County seems to be doing its part. Okay, more scary news. In the most recent week, our positivity rate of those tested went to 22%. This is up from 15% in the previous week. We have done 2,455 tests in the last week, and 546 were positive. Now, I might add that average daily number of tests is only about 350 tests a day, and this is down from recent weeks. So, in fact, we're actually testing less people, but the rate is going up and the number of total positives is going up. In Ohio, we're seeing a similar trend, although the positivity rates are a lot lower. We've climbed up to 6.5% positivity rate over the last week, and the most recent day was 7.1%. Now, in the last couple weeks, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department has held two press briefings, and the most recent one was with healthcare providers. Probably the biggest gist of this is that there is no grand plan to increase testing. This is not something they talked about so much directly, but upon questioning. And this last media briefing, the UT Medical Center medical director confirmed that this is the case, that we don't really have any great plan to increase. UTMC, their lab does about half of local testing, and they seem to be focusing on their own patients and the University of Toledo community, and seem to be satisfied with the amount of lab testing they're doing right now. Okay. Well, one thing also that was said by the UTMC medical director that I found a little bit surprising and probably indicative of the contrast between a medical approach and a public health approach is that he cited that only 1% to 2% of non-COVID patients who are tested are turning up positive, meaning that every patient that is admitted, whether they're COVID or non-COVID, is tested. And the ones who aren't coming in for a COVID diagnosis, 1% to 2% of those are also showing up positive. And of course, he called this a very low rate. And certainly 1% to 2% seems very low. But one thing too is that this is a sampling of the sickest people in the community. And if the sickest people, the most vulnerable people in the community, are getting a 1% to 2% positivity rate, unbeknownst until they get admitted to the hospital, that is very scary. Now, that's bad enough if it's happening among the most vulnerable, but let's just say that's just the case even among the general population in Lucas County. If you had a just 1% positivity rate in Lucas County, that would be over 4,000 infected people in the county at this moment. So these small numbers that seem small from a medical perspective, from a public health perspective, can be frightening. Okay, well, we know that when COVID-19 goes throughout the community, you've heard a lot in the last couple months about it being in younger people, and that's not nearly as bad. Well, I've been saying all along, as many others, that if you are living in a sea of COVID, it'll eventually seep into those that are most vulnerable. Sure enough, in nursing homes this week, we're back up to over 80 cases from running in the 20s the previous few weeks. And this is the highest number of COVID-19 cases we've had in nursing homes in Lucas County in months. And the positivity rate, as I reported earlier, has been creeping up from a few weeks ago from 3.3% to 3.6% to 3.9%. This most recent week, 4.9%. So seems like things are taking off. Okay, well, at the University of Toledo, they bumped up back to the 20s, 25 cases, which has been about where they've been hanging. They only had 13 last week, but they've been in the 20s a few weeks before that. So that doesn't seem too terrible, although the interesting thing about this last week's testing is they had a 3.7% positivity rate among those that were just tested at random. So this would be people that are asymptomatic that were asked to come in and get tested just to see how many people might be infected. So that's been the highest rate that we've had. And also a first is that of these 25, the majority of these were positives that were identified through this asymptomatic surveillance. So maybe our testing isn't all that adequate in the community and the surveillance is actually picking up a higher underlying rate. Again, going back to our positivity rate of 22% in the broader community, the recommendation for adequate testing is if you have that rate under 5%. So we are way, 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 that's four way, ways above for over 400% higher. Yikes. Okay, well, also in Lucas County schools, we set a new record this last week. We've had 29 staff and 29 students that were reported positive this week, this most recent week. That was up from the previous high the week before of 12 staff and 17 students. Now, these rates are still not sky high, but of course, they're not moving in the right direction. And we would expect that if COVID is out in the community, that we'll find it in the schools as well. Okay, well, let's take a little closer look at Ohio, which has been, like I said, doing its part in the epidemic in this country. This from the Columbus Dispatch. Ohio sets more COVID records with 3,845 new cases and hospitalizations at all-time high. Ohio once again shattered its daily record for new coronavirus cases on Friday, that would be yesterday, as 3,845 more residents tested positive. Friday's new cases were 7.1% higher than the previous record of 3,590 new cases set Thursday, the day before, state health department data shows. It marks the second time Ohio's newly reported cases have exceeded 3,000 a day and the 15th time it has been above 2,000 cases. The new cases yesterday also were 1,622 more than the three-week daily average of 2,223 new cases. A total of 1,629 Ohioans remain hospitalized with COVID-19 as of yesterday, which is the highest number since the pandemic began in March. The total hospitalized represents a 6.1% increase. As Ohio's cases and the positive test rate continue to climb, it's unlikely the state is anywhere near its peak in the current COVID-19 wave, said Dr. Joseph Gastaldo, Medical Director of Infectious Diseases for Ohio Health. With fall and winter holidays fast approaching and people moving indoors because of cold weather, cases will probably continue to increase for a while. It's likely, he said, that Ohio's new cases and positive test rate won't peak until after the holidays. I think he means Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's. It really depends on what the governor does and whether people are adhering to mitigation policies, Gastaldo said. We all need to be very concerned. We need to talk about it, and people really need to get on board. Well, of course, Governor DeWine, who has received some kudos for responding this in the past, but in my book has gotten lower grades as we've gone on, is basically just encouraging people to do the same old things, you know, without any additional requirements or restrictions for people to mask up, to social distance, and not go in large gatherings, to wash your hands. You've heard it all before. But for citizen number one, Governor DeWine, is he going to do something more significant as the number one policy setter for Ohio? It remains to be seen. In Lucas County, at the press briefing, when they were asked about such restrictions, particularly around like restaurants and bars, the health department said it's something that's always being considered, but they are definitely nowhere near to making such a decision. So locally, it doesn't look like we're getting close to doing that either. So folks, here it comes.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, turning to the national picture with COVID-19, this from the Hill. U.S. records 97,000 new COVID-19 cases, shattering daily record. The U.S. recorded roughly 97,000 new coronavirus cases yesterday, shattering the previous record for the highest number of new cases in a single day. Data from the COVID-19 tracking project show there were 97,080 new cases on Friday, ushering in an alarming new milestone that comes as dozens of states across the country see spikes in infections. The figure broke the previous record of 88,521 new coronavirus cases, which was set on Thursday, the day before. The nationwide surge in cases comes just ahead of a winter season during which experts say the increase will be exacerbated as social gatherings move indoors where the virus can spread more easily. And of course, With fast-paced news and this being a pre-recorded show, we may very well have crashed through the 100,000 mark by the time you have heard this. Now, the thing that I find most scary in all of this is that since this is a novel coronavirus, novel infectious respiratory transmitted disease that has serious health consequences, we don't know what the upper limit of what this might be as far as infections as they rage on. In the United Kingdom, this week, they had over 100,000 cases in a single day. That's a country of about 90 million people. So if you translate to an equivalent rate in the U.S., that would be something akin to 300,000 or 400,000 cases a day. And the U.K. is not done. It's not like they've peaked. So there is no real natural limit if we do not ourselves decide to control this virus. That is very scary. Okay, well, continuing with the national scene, next up from the Hill, winter COVID-19 wave poses threat to nation's hospitals. Coronavirus hospitalizations are rising in the United States as wave builds ahead of winter, threatening to overwhelm hospitals in some areas. Several major European countries currently have even worse outbreaks than the U.S., but former Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Scott Gottlieb warned Wednesday that the U.S. is on a trajectory to match them in about 3 weeks. Already, hospitals in some areas of the U.S. are showing strain given the ever-mounting rise in cases and hospitalizations, which are not showing any signs of slowing down. In El Paso, Texas, authorities are setting up a field hospital at the convention center to help deal with the surge in hospitalizations. In Utah, the head of the state hospitalization told the Salt Lake Tribune that hospitals are on a trajectory to soon have to start rationing care. Our hospitals cannot keep up with Utah's infection rate, Governor Gary Herbert tweeted Thursday. You deserve to understand the dire situation we face. Kootenai Health, a hospital in Idaho, warned in a statement last week that it was 99% full and that many hospitals in the area were not accepting patients to be transferred because they are also at capacity. Hospital capacity is going to be a paramount concern, said Dr. Amish Adalja, a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. While hospital treatment for coronavirus has improved since the early days of the pandemic, with new drugs available like remdesivir and dexamethasone, and improved knowledge among doctors, once capacity is overwhelmed, that is no longer true. When hospital capacity is compromised, we know that care will decline. Hospitalizations nationally have risen to about 45,000 people, up from around 30,000 at the beginning of the month. Those numbers are still rising, according to the COVID Tracking Project. France and Germany announced partial lockdowns on Wednesday, a sign of the worsening situation there. Such drastic measures are not expected on a national level in the United States, though experts expect many states and localities will have to implement at least targeted measures like closing bars and indoor dining as the situation worsens. The surge occurs just days ahead of Election Day as President Trump continues to downplay the virus. He has mocked the idea of wearing a mask and said that more testing makes the country look bad by identifying more cases while calling to, quote, open our country. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows even said, we're not going to control the pandemic, on CNN on Sunday. Democratic nominee Joe Biden is pushing for the federal government to take a much more active role in ramping up testing, calling for governors to impose mask mandates and publishing evidence-based national guidance on which businesses should open or close based on infection rates in the area. Many experts are calling for mask mandates at a minimum and say closing places like bars and indoor dining can also help. Bars and indoor dining are probably one of our riskier places, said Jody Guest, an epidemiologist at Emory University, adding that a household gathering should also generally be kept below 10 people. As hospitals fill up, they are urging people in the community to take precautions like mask wearing, washing hands, and avoiding crowded places to slow the spread of the virus. Elizabeth Middleton, a pulmonologist with the University of Utah Hospital System, said, it's kind of like a kick in the teeth when people do not wear masks. She said the hospital has had to set up a surge ICU capacity to deal with the influx of patients. And while they are not overwhelming capacity yet, of course, I'm worried we're going to get there. It's just like being in a washing machine. You jump in, everything is spinning, and then you just come out haggard, she said. Carrie Kroll, a vice president at the Texas Hospital Association, said hospitals in El Paso and the western part of the state are being strained most right now, but it's just not going to be in that area for much longer. Hospitals are doing innovative things to try to get at the moment, Kroll said. like moving some adult non-COVID patients into a children's hospital in El Paso to free up space at other facilities. We are aware that certainly at some point you could get to the point where there's so many patients that you start to bridge that capacity issue. We're just sort of unwilling to throw in the towel, she said. While Europe has now seen a surge in cases, with its current outbreak surpassing the United States, the U.S. still has some of the worst numbers in the world for cases and deaths, and remains significantly ahead of Europe in cumulative per capita deaths. In fact, the U.S. is 11th in the world for coronavirus deaths per capita, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. While Europe and U.S. are both seeing renewed surges now, some countries have been able to keep the virus suppressed, most notably South Korea with an extensive testing system, and New Zealand with a quick lockdown that helped cut off transmission and allowed their reopening. We're maybe about 3 weeks behind Europe, maybe a month at the most, so we're on a trajectory to look a lot like Europe as we enter the month of November, Gottlieb said on CNBC. So I think things are going to get worse. Okay, I've reported earlier on my show and earlier in this show about doing surveillance through sewage, and we're going to do a national story on that right now from CNN. Sewage testing shows a country flush with coronavirus cases. Gotta appreciate the pun, too. When Rosa Inchosta and her colleagues started testing wastewater in Tempe, Arizona, it was 2018, and they were not looking for a coronavirus. They were tracking the opioid epidemic. But because they were set up to sample the city sector by sector, they were able to switch gears and begin sampling sewage for evidence of coronavirus. We were ready for this, Inchosta told CNN. And I like to make an editorial note. This is an advantage of having a robust public health infrastructure. When things switch out, you're ready when it comes. You don't have to like build the infrastructure in the middle of a crisis. Okay, back to the story. Now the city is regularly sampling sewage to keep an eye on the pandemic, and things are not looking good in parts of Tempe, and they're not looking good in Boston, or in Reno, Nevada, or in many other cities across the country. BioBot Analytics has been analyzing sewage looking for evidence of coronavirus for dozens of customers, including Boston. As daily coronavirus counts top 70,000 as measured by standard testing, sewage testing suggests things are going to get a whole lot worse. It's a leading indicator, Inchosta said. The proof is in the poop. Across the country, cities and universities are testing sewage to monitor the virus. Studies suggest it's a useful way to augment standard person-by-person coronavirus testing. And while a sewage sample cannot point to an infected individual, it can give an indication that infections are circulating in an area, a neighborhood, or even in an individual building. Early on in the pandemic, it became clear that COVID-19 virus makes its way into the digestive system and could be found in human feces. From there, it's just a quick flush into the sewers. Mariana Mattis, a co-founder and CEO of BioBot Analytics, which is analyzing sewage for dozens of customers, said sewage testing can show viruses starting to circulate even before people start showing up at hospitals and clinics and before they start lining up for COVID-19 tests. People start shedding virus pretty quickly after they are infected and before they start showing symptoms, Mattis told CNN. The results are clear on the Massachusetts Water Resources Authority website, which displays BioBot's analysis of data covering 2 million water customers in the Boston area, or sewage customers in the Boston area. It shows a spike in viral samples in April and May, falling back through the summer. Now the virus is showing up again, with samples at levels close to what they have seen at the height of the pandemic in the spring. We are seeing an upturn in the wastewater data, which I think broadly matches what we are seeing across the country. It's been interesting seeing this almost second wave. Massachusetts still has a low percentage of coronavirus tests coming back positive at 1.5%, but the growing number of positive hits from the sewage indicate more positive tests are to come, Mattis said. I think that it is pretty good evidence that we need to pay attention. Communities need to pay attention, said Mattis, a biologist who started the company with a small group of colleagues at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The little startup has been deluged with requests to test wastewater systems, she said. Who doesn't like a poop story, Mattis asked. Testing the sewage for evidence of COVID-19 is like preparing a weather forecast, said Krishna Pagula, chair of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Nevada, Reno, and director of the Nevada Water Innovation Institute. This is something we should have concentrated on from the beginning in every community, Reno's Pagula told CNN. The coronavirus breaks down fairly quickly once it's flushed. Wastewater testing doesn't recover whole virus, but instead pulls out two specific pieces of viral material called RNA. It can no longer infect people, but it's easy to identify. Finding this RNA in the sewage tells researchers someone infected is using the system. The more RNA is there, the more people are infected. We will know a few days in advance. We can inform the health authorities. It's especially useful in a college town, Pagula said. People are reluctant to get tested now, he said. Or we have students who say, hey, I'm having symptoms, but I'm going to hang out at home. They don't get seriously ill, so they don't get tested. But then maybe they decide to go on to the gym. In Tempe, Inquesta said the city makes even more direct use of information. The relationship is never just to have the data and look at it and say, that's nice, she said. Instead, she said, who is the city? Instead, she... Inquesta, who is the city's strategic management and diversity director, said her team publishes the data on a public website and has used it to target low-income neighborhoods heavily populated by minorities who are at most risk of dying from COVID-19. One, designated Area 6, abuts the Arizona State University campus. Its 8,100 residents are largely low-income. When coronavirus RNA counts went up in the sewage there recently, we spent $15,000 blitzing it with masks. We met people where they are, she added. We understand they are going to the laundromat, so we helped them understand how to stay safe in the laundromat. We provided COVID-19 saliva testing in the school and in the neighborhood. Now they're analyzing test data to see if the intervention made a difference. I believe what Tempe is doing is the right way to do it, Pagula said. Creston Mansfeld says she thinks it made a difference on the campus at the University of Colorado in Boulder. The school has coordinated saliva tests for on-campus residents with regular wastewater monitoring conducted by students. They look at the data daily, said Mansfeld, an assistant professor of environmental engineering, who normally studies how microbes interact with the chemicals people excrete in their waste. There's a lot of information that people flush down the toilet, Mansfeld said. Numbers shot up in the weeks after students returned to campus in late August, peaking at 130 positive PCR tests on September 17th. But they plummeted to just a few a day after the city and county of Boulder instituted restrictions on college-age residents that prevented gatherings of any size, not even two people, for 2 weeks. Officials relented after a week when students complained of safety issues, allowing those age 18 to 22 to travel in pairs. Currently, 18 to 22-year-olds are no longer restricted any more than any other age group in Boulder County. Now campus cases are ticking up again, from one case on October 16th, to 5 on October 22nd and 8 on October 26th. But Mansfeld said the wastewater indicators look good. Most sewers are testing negative, he said. In Chausta and Pagua, both said they hoped state and federal officials would pay attention and start using sewage data to monitor the pandemic across the country as a whole and to respond. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has set up a website and is hoping state, tribal, local, and territorial health departments will submit wastewater testing data for a national database. However, at this time, point estimates of community infection based on wastewater measurements should not be used, the CDC advises. Now, what they mean by point estimates is giving, it's understood to be a very general thing. So it's kind of like, you know, a thumbnail kind of estimate rather than doing super precise kind of things. But definitely can give us a heads up. Okay, well, as winter comes upon us in much of the country, and people move inside, this next story is all the more important. This from Science Daily. Study finds faster, wider spread of COVID-19 in U.S. households. COVID-19 spreads faster and more widely throughout U.S. households than previously reported, according to new preliminary research from a multi-center study led by Vanderbilt University Medical Center researchers and published in MMWR, a weekly report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The study, led by Carlos Grijalva, Associate Professor of Health Policy, and H. Kipe Talbot, Associate Professor of Medicine, found that 51% of others living in the home with someone who was positive for COVID-19 also became infected. We observed that after a first household member became sick, several infections were rapidly detected in the household, Grijalva said. Those infections occurred fast, whether the first sick household member was a child or an adult. The study found that at least 75% of the secondary household infections occurred within 5 days of the first person in the household experiencing symptoms. The preliminary research is the first to closely follow U.S. households through systematic daily assessments and study the transmission of coronavirus among groups living together under one roof. Other similar studies have mostly been conducted abroad, and others have made estimates of household transmission using contact tracing data. Similar studies in the U.S., Europe, and Asia have reported that 30% or less of household members also became infected. Also among the study's findings that less than half of household members experienced symptoms when they first tested positive, and many reported no symptoms throughout the 7-day follow-up period. The study result underscores the potential for transmission from symptomatic or asymptomatic contact with household members and the importance of quarantine, Grijalva said. Persons aware of recent close contact with an infected person, such as household members, should quarantine at home and monitor for development of symptoms. As winter approaches, the people start spending more in time indoors, it will be important to prepare for potential infections at home. In the absence of an efficient approach for identification of infections without regard to symptoms, these findings suggest that prompt adoption of isolation measures as soon as a person feels ill might reduce the probability of household transmission, the authors concluded. Okay, and addressing another important issue in COVID-19, this from Yale University. Childcare not associated with spread of COVID-19, Yale study finds. Yale research conducted the first ever large-scale assessment of the risk of working in childcare during the COVID-19 pandemic. Their findings show childcare programs that remained open throughout the pandemic did not contribute to the spread of the virus to providers, lending valuable insight to parents, policymakers, and providers alike. The study, published in the journal Pediatrics, found that exposure to childcare was not associated with an elevated risk of spreading COVID-19 from children to adults, provided the child care programs took multiple safety measures, including disinfecting, hand washing, symptom screening, social distancing, mask wearing, and limiting group size, and were located in communities where the spread of COVID-19 was contained. That's a lot of ifs. That doesn't mean that child care workers avoided the novel coronavirus entirely. The study found that Black, Latino, and Native American child care providers were more likely to test positive for COVID-19 and be hospitalized for it. And in counties with higher rates of coronavirus deaths, the study's marker of community spread, child care workers were more likely to contract the virus. Importantly, the research revealed that child care programs that stayed open were particularly conscientious in following recommended infection control measures. Over 90% of child care providers in open programs reported frequent hand washing and disinfection of services. The survey also showed that child care sites had high rates of other infection control measures, like daily symptoms checks, physical distancing, and cohorting, which means not mixing children or items between child groups. Researchers stressed that infection control practices remain critical, especially in light of vigilance fatigue, a tendency to become less careful and consistent in efforts to protect against a threat as time goes on. The study comes at a time when policymakers at all levels are weighing the cost and benefits of reopening businesses and community institutions, but sometimes without the benefit of data to guide their assessment of potential consequences. Given that 35% of jobs in childcare were lost between February and April, many childcare professionals are eager to get back to work too. Our study doesn't fully answer the question of whether to reopen childcare or not. We don't have data on children's risk, and local levels of community spread matter a lot. But our study does offer solid evidence that under certain conditions, it's possible to open childcare programs without putting staff in harm's way. Chief among these conditions are low rates of community spread, with local positive test rates under 5%, and high rates of protective practices in the childcare setting, including physical distancing, frequent hand washing, and cohorting. The study's authors cautioned that their findings do not necessarily apply to teachers who work in schools or other settings with older children. Adults who work with infants, toddlers, and preschoolers typically have a small group of children who stay together all day, said Gilliam. Middle schools and high schools may have hundreds of people in a building and typically move from class to class. Those factors alone make K-12 schools very different from child care programs. And also, we know from the amount of infectivity, it seems that around puberty, in other words, your later middle school and high school kids are going to be pretty much be seen as adults as far as infectiousness with this disease. While this is good news, it only really applies for areas with low levels of community infection. And considering that the positivity for the nation is over 6%, that means it's most likely that you're living in a place that is not below 5. So if you are, then child care cannot be a particularly added burden on disease transmission in your community, but that shifts and is a different story when you have higher community rates. All the reason more why we should prioritize closing perhaps things like bars and restaurants and maybe keep the schools open. Gotta have priorities. And, to that point, this from the New York Times. Winter is coming for bars. Here's how to save them and us. If we really want to stem the spread of the coronavirus as winter looms and we wait for a vaccine, here's an idea. The government should pay bars, many restaurants, and event venues to close for some months. That may sound radical, but it makes scientific sense and even has a political precedent. We pay farmers not to cultivate some fields, in theory at least, to protect the environment, so why not pay bars that cannot operate safely to shut down to protect public health? In the past 9 months, we've learned a lot about this particular coronavirus and how it's most likely to spread. Drinking establishments and indoor event venues have emerged as ideal environments for transmission, and there's good scientific logic to explain that. Viruses are not villains who go after their prey. They're passive opportunists. Some spread through food or when left on surfaces. Others, like this coronavirus, can be transmitted through teeny droplets that can linger in the air after an infected person coughs, talks, or breathes. The virus spreads most easily indoors and particularly in crowded, poorly ventilated places. More important, people can be infectious while their bodies are incubating the virus for a couple days before they develop symptoms, or even if they never develop symptoms at all. So you can go to a bar or a wedding feeling top-notch, or maybe just a little off. Drink, kiss, and dance till you drop, then you wake up the next morning feeling awful. It's not just a hangover, it's COVID-19. That explains why this particular virus is unusually defined by being contracted at super spreader events, more so than the flu, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. A person who is shedding a good deal of the virus still feels well enough to hang out in a tight, likely indoor space where people mingle boisterously with others they don't know or don't see often, and they can wear masks, and they can't wear masks because they're drinking or eating. No wonder bars are a problem. In scientific parlance, the coronavirus is more of a heterogeneous rather than homogeneous spreader, according to Bjarke Frost Nielsen, a researcher at the Niels Bohr Institute at the University of Copenhagen. Along with his colleague Kim Sneppen, he uses mathematical modeling to study the pattern of the spread of the virus. What heterogeneous spread means is that it tends to expand in burst-like outbreaks, often centered on a particular meeting place, a hotspot, rather than oozing slowly across the country. There's some good news in this finding, Mr. Nielsen told me. You can close down certain types of gatherings in a few types of places and tamp down the majority of the spread of the disease, and you can carry on with the rest as pretty normal. Back when we knew little about the novel coronavirus, the government responded with a hammer. The Paycheck Protection Program treated all small businesses equally, providing them with loans to shut down so long as they paid their employees. Now we can use more delicate instruments. Food and clothing stores, indeed most any kind of shop, can function safely with masking and attention to distancing and sanitizing. We don't go to these places to chat, and we can all wear masks inside them. Factories and assembly lines can protect workers with masking and spacing. Schools can do the same for students. Even movie theaters can arguably safely operate with masked patrons, quality ventilation systems, and spacing between viewers or viewing groups. They might not just be able to sell as many seats. But bars and restaurants that depend on packed indoor dining and concert halls with dance floors, most are attractive for exactly the reasons that make them such petri dishes for the coronavirus. The crowding, the drinking, the carousing with new, different people. That's why some bar and restaurant owners say they would welcome a program that compensated them to shut their doors this winter. Peter Kurzweg, who co-owns three of what he calls drink forward establishments in Pittsburgh that used to have bustling happy hours, says that bars and restaurants are unique in that to be really safe, they have to mitigate to a point where it's not a bar or restaurant experience anymore. He and his partners have so far weathered the pandemic with outdoor seating on the sidewalk and in an alley. They have taken advantage of government loan programs. They have invested in tents and heaters and encouraged patrons to lean in to having fun outside. But as fall turns to winter in Pittsburgh, he knows it won't last. I walk around saying, winter is coming, winter is coming. We need to do everything we can to survive. Some states have allowed restaurants to open indoors at 25% or 50% capacity. Indeed, that is permitted now in Pittsburgh. But Mr. Kurzweg has not done so because he doesn't feel it's safe. Anyway, he added, no bar or restaurant can make it at that capacity. On the best days in normal years, our profit margins are at 10%. Some very spacious high-end restaurants and those in temperate climates might be able to make it work. Most can't. Bars and other venues that depend on drinks are not essential services. We want them to survive so that in the future we can enjoy them. So why not pay owners who cannot keep their businesses afloat safely during the pandemic on an average of their normal monthly income to shut down for the some months? They would keep paying their employees and help break the chain of coronavirus transmission. Maybe we could get creative and ask them to use their kitchens to help feed Americans who are going hungry. With bars closed, you could still drink and socialize with smaller groups of people at home or outdoors when the weather allows it. That may not be quite as much fun, but nothing is much fun so long as the coronavirus is around. Okay, well, as we know that the rising tide of COVID-19 will seep into places that are very high risk, this next news from Stat News is all the more important. Why isn't routine COVID-19 testing happening in prisons and immigrant detention centers? The path to establishing widespread COVID-19 testing in the United States has been slow and painful. There finally appear to be preliminary levels of success in some institutions with congregate housing where individuals cannot easily socially distance. These institutions are rapidly implementing routine testing to identify positive cases and mitigate the spread of COVID-19. Yet, routine testing in congregate housing settings is not being universally or equitably implemented. It has been deployed in universities and nursing homes, but is not being used in prisons, jails, and immigration detention centers. This unequal distribution of resources demonstrates how the needs of vulnerable populations are often disregarded and ignored. Nursing homes were one of the first institutions to adopt the model of frequent testing, largely to protect their older populations, which have higher death rates from COVID-19 than younger populations. Many local health departments across the country adopted routine testing protocols for residents and staff of nursing homes and long-term care facilities. When these facilities face supply chain and funding challenges for continued testing, the Department of Health and Human Services procured hundreds of millions of point-of-care testing kits. College and universities with congregate housing have followed suit. Many colleges have scaled up testing for students to allow for hybrid education models, sometimes up to 3 times a week at places like Amherst College and Harvard University. Harvard has been able to sustain such expanded testing measures by partnering with organizations such as the university-affiliated Broad Institute and the third-party vendor Color. Achieving weekly mass testing is to effectively isolate COVID-19 cases and protect communities is commendable, but as our government institutions operationalize testing to establish a new normal, it is important to be aware of how resources are being allocated and which lives are prioritized and ultimately saved. Other large testing for congregate housing, such as prisons, jails, and immigration detention centers, have not provided testing anywhere near the levels achieved by universities and nursing homes, even though they have experienced massive COVID-19 outbreaks and house vulnerable individuals who disproportionately live with comorbidities that increase their risk of developing COVID-19-related complications. Most testing performed in correctional immigration detention facilities is still reactionary. Only symptomatic individuals get tested, and many of these facilities have not performed mass testing at a single time, let alone routinely. In settings where even soap can be hard to come by, the lack of testing has proven to be a disaster. The infection rate in federal prisons and jails is nearly 6 times higher than the rate among the U.S. population as a whole, while the age-adjusted death rate is 3 times higher. In 16 prisons and jails where mass asymptomatic testing has been implemented, the true burden of COVID-19 infection was found to be 12 times higher than levels previously established by symptom-based testing. Not testing those in facilities can put entire communities at risk. A University of Chicago researcher estimated that in the spring of 2020, nearly 16% of all COVID-19 infections in Illinois may have been linked to Chicago's sprawling Cook County Jail. Since then, however, Cook County Jail officials, with help from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, have ramped up testing and other measures to significantly limit the spread of COVID-19. Unlike in nursing homes and universities, the barriers to testing inside correctional and immigration detention facilities are incredibly high. Our research team at the Harvard Asylum Clinic interviews individuals held in immigration and customs enforcement detention centers across the country. We recently spoke to a detainee who had a cough for 2 days but was denied testing because he wasn't, quote, sick enough. Last week, we spoke to another detainee who did not report her symptoms to staff because she feared of being sent to the hole for medical isolation. It's a stark contrast. Asymptomatic students get tested twice a week so they can meet in large groups to build their professional networks, while a detained man with a cough is denied testing and forced to return to his dormitory where he shares a room with 50 other people. Our priorities must change. Correctional and immigration detention facilities often report, in line with guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that they do not provide mass testing because they do not have sufficient staffing and housing infrastructure to appropriately respond to the results of testing with appropriate contact tracing and isolation. When lives are at stake, such reasoning is unacceptable. Alternative venues that make mass routine testing and isolation possible, such as reducing the incarcerated population, building housing infrastructure, and expanding funding for point-of-care testing, correctional and immigration detention facilities, must be pursued. The failure to provide routine testing to these high-risk populations is driven by the lack of a national testing strategy. The Trump administration's decision to shift the responsibility of testing to states that compete with one another for limited resources has contributed to disparities in which populations are tested. While the National Institutes of Health recently expanded funding for COVID-19 testing among underserved populations, additional direct investment and testing mandates are essential for correctional and immigration detention facilities. Without them, the federal government is turning a blind eye to populations it is tasked to protect. People in correctional and immigration detention facilities are people with families, passions, and aspirations whose lives are worth protecting. We must organize, mobilize, and invest resources to protect them, just as we are doing for students and the elderly. Amen to that. The only thing I would add really to this article is it gives an impression that we're doing a lot of testing in colleges and universities, which is really not the case. The fact is we have failed on so many fronts. But when you specifically have the government responsible for a congregate, imprisoned or detained population, they have a responsibility to protect those populations. Partly because they can't protect themselves, but they're in situations where obviously it can infect themselves and others very rapidly and very quickly. And like they said with the Cook County thing, you know, it gets out in the community, comes in from the community, gets back out in the community. So we all need to protect each other. Okay, well, as the epidemic progresses, we get a little idea about what the status is on the kind of the political and opinion landscape. This from NBC News, poll, majority of Americans know someone who's had COVID-19. Majority of American adults say they know someone who has been diagnosed with COVID-19, according to new data from the NBC News SurveyMonkey weekly tracking poll. 68% of adults say they know someone who's had the coronavirus since December, while 31% say they don't know someone who's been diagnosed with the virus. 34% of adults say either they or someone in their household has been tested for the coronavirus in the past month, while 64% say no one in their house has been tested. While older adults are more at risk of severe symptoms from COVID-19, there was little difference across age demographics when people were asked whether they know someone who had contracted the virus. 65% of adults 18 to 34 know someone who's had the virus. 71% of Americans aged 35 to 64 said the same. And in the most at-risk age category, 65 and older, 63% said they know someone who's been diagnosed. Despite President Donald Trump's rhetoric that increased testing is to blame for the spike in the case numbers, there was nearly no discrepancy among people getting tested when the data are broken down by party. 33% of Republicans and those who lean Republican report that either they or someone in their household has been tested for COVID-19 in the last 30 days. 36% of Democrats and those who lean Democratic say the same. 34% of independents say they or someone in their home has been tested in the last month. 66% of Republicans and those who lean Republican say they know someone who's been diagnosed. 72% of Democrats and those who lean Democrat say they know someone who has contracted the disease. 61% of independents say they know someone who has been diagnosed. The same trend is true when it comes to people's income brackets and race. 58% of adults who make under $50,000 a year say they know someone who has been diagnosed, and 34% say they or someone in their home has been tested in the last month. Among adults making $50,000 to $99,000, 71% say they know someone who has been diagnosed, and 33% say they or someone they live with has been tested in the last 30 days. And 78% of Americans making more than $100,000 a year say they know someone who has contracted COVID-19, and 30% of them say they or someone in their home has been tested in the last month. Similarly, 69% of white adults report that they know someone who has been diagnosed, and 34% say that they or someone in their home has been tested in the last 30 days. Similarly, 67% of black adults and 67% of Hispanic adults say they know someone who has contracted the virus, while 36% of black adults and 36% of Hispanics say they or someone in their home has been tested in the past month. 56% of Asian adults say they know someone who's had the disease, and 32% say they or someone in their home has been tested in the last 30 days. Other COVID-19-related numbers in the polls have remained stagnant, both as to how Americans view the virus and its effect on their lives, and how do they view Trump in relation to the virus. 74% of adults say the coronavirus has had a, quote, very major or, quote, fairly major effect on their daily lives, the same proportion who felt that when they were asked 2 weeks ago. 44% of adults say they approve of Trump's handling of the virus response, while 54% say they don't, a number that has remained virtually unchanged over months of polling. And 53% of adults are more concerned that businesses in their area are reopening too quickly, compared to 43% who are more concerned about a slower reopening, another number that has remained stable in recent weeks since a tightening of those numbers emerged in September. Okay, well, as the epidemic worsens, many people are very interested in wondering when a vaccine will come and how that will happen. This from the Washington Post. States say they lack federal funds to distribute coronavirus vaccine as CDC tells them to be ready by November 15th. State health officials are expressing frustration about a lack of federal financial support as they face orders to prepare to receive and distribute the first doses of a coronavirus vaccine by November 15th, even though one is not likely to be approved until later this year. The officials say they don't have enough money to pay for the enormous and complicated undertaking. State officials have been planning in earnest in recent weeks to get shots into arms, even though no one knows which vaccine will be authorized by the Food and Drug Administration, what special storage and handling may be required, and how many doses each state will receive. Despite the uncertainties over timing of vaccine approval and number of initial doses, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is asking states to be prepared to preposition doses in key locations throughout the country. Officials want to move quickly once the FDA authorizes a vaccine and the CDC advisory panel issues recommendations on which population should be vaccinated, according to a letter the CDC sent Monday to state preparedness and immunization officials. As part of that effort, the CDC is asking states to provide by Tuesday critical information, including a list of each jurisdiction's top five sites capable of receiving and administering a vaccine that must be stored at ultra-cold temperatures of minus 70 Celsius, that's minus 94 Fahrenheit. The letter refers to the vaccine only as Vaccine A, but industry and health officials have identified it as Pfizer's candidate. Pfizer Chief Executive Albert Bourla said Tuesday that hundreds of thousands of doses have already been produced and that a first look at the data would occur soon. Pfizer will not apply for any authorization of its vaccine sooner than the third week of November, when it will have sufficient safety data. We acknowledge that you are being asked to do unprecedented work, wrote Nancy Messonnier, director of the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, which is leading the CDC's role in vaccine distribution. She added, "This is a new planning ask." State officials say they have been trying to raise the issue with federal officials, but have received little response. It is absolutely ridiculous that the administration, after spending $10 billion for a warp speed effort to develop a vaccine, has no interest in a similar investment in a warp speed campaign to get the vaccine to every American as quickly as possible after it's approved, said Michael Fraser, executive director of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. Operation Warp Speed is the federal initiative, funded by more than $10 billion of taxpayer money, to fast-track development of coronavirus countermeasures. The now accelerated timeline underscores the need to address the issue of funding for state and territorial health agencies to make all this work, Fraser said. There are many other costs that have no clear way to be paid for this at this point. Local officials still need to recruit thousands of people to staff vaccine clinics and enroll and train providers. They also have to ramp up information technology and data systems to track vaccine inventory and ordering to ensure people get the correct doses at the right times. Most vaccines will require two shots, and to monitor for adverse events. They will need to develop locally tailored vaccination communication campaigns too. States have received some funding, but it's not nearly enough to support the scale, scope, and speed that is needed, said Claire Hannon, executive director of the Association of Immunization Managers, whose members direct public health immunization programs throughout the country. States and territories have received $200 million from the CDC to do planning, they said. In the next emergency supplemental funding package, they're asking Congress for at least $8 billion for coronavirus vaccination and $500 million for seasonal influenza vaccine operations, they said in a recent letter to congressional leaders. Recruiting and training workers for coronavirus vaccine campaigns will cost at least $3 billion. Another $1.2 billion will be needed for cold supply chain management, $1 billion for arranging additional vaccination sites, and $500 million for data information systems upgrades. Last month, CDC Director Robert Redfield testified before a congressional committee that roughly $6 billion is needed for the CDC to support states for coronavirus vaccine distribution, which will take place in phases well into next year. Without additional money, it's kind of like setting up tent poles without having the tent, Nirav Shah, director of Maine's Center for Disease Control and Prevention, said during a recent call with reporters. Well, this is just part of my ongoing coverage on the hugely complicated task of not only developing a vaccine, but even more complicated is getting it out quickly and equitably to those that need it. This is an ongoing story. Stay tuned. Okay, well, as I've reported periodically throughout the pandemic, there are issues with supply chains both within the country and across the world. And of course, the pandemic is raging not only in the United States, but elsewhere in the world. So this from Stat News. As COVID-19 intensifies, shortages of staple drugs may grow worse. You can add a new worry to the health concerns caused by COVID-19, a sustained shortage of medicines needed to combat the coronavirus and countless other illnesses. Across the U.S. and Europe, 29 out of 40 drugs used to combat the coronavirus are currently in short supply, and those shortages are expected to grow even worse as the number of COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations surge in the coming winter months, according to a new report by the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Moreover, the problem is likely to be exacerbated by the vagaries of the global pharmaceutical supply chain, which is heavily dependent on China for active pharmaceutical ingredients and on manufacturers based in India. As of now, 43% or 67 of 156 acute care medicines used to treat various illnesses are running low. This group includes such staples as antibiotics, blood thinners, and sedatives. The supply chain has already been stressed over the past few years, but as we go through the fall and into the winter, we're going to have some real challenges thanks to COVID-19, said Michael Osterholm, director of the center and co-principal investigator of the center's Resilient Drug Supply Project. Indeed, the pandemic has exposed many of the vulnerabilities in the U.S. drug supply chain, according to the report. COVID-19 tends to strike hard in a discrete geographic area, and when it creates a new hotspot, the hospitals in that area usually see a dramatic spike in admissions and ventilator use. As examples, they foresee the possibility of a five-fold jump in demand for midazolam, a commonly used sedative, and a tenfold increase in the use of a muscle relaxant known as sisatricurium. There are ongoing shortages of such medicines in the spring. There were ongoing shortages of such medicines in the spring as the number of COVID-19 cases in the New York area skyrocketed. Over the next several months, though, such shortages could easily grow if there is a surge in multiple parts of the country around the same time, a scenario that has started to play out. This time, we may approach a surge not with five or six hotspots, but maybe something like 30 or more hotspots, explained Stefan Schandelmeier, another co-principal investigator of the Resilient Drug Supply Project. If they're all having a surge at the same time, we don't have the ability to shift supplies around as we tried to do in the spring. The concern arises after years in which the U.S. pharmaceutical supply chain has been regularly hindered by shortages, and this occurs at great cost, according to the report. Overall, U.S. health systems spend more than $500 million a year on estimated costs related to drug shortages, with approximately $200 million in direct costs and up to $360 million in indirect costs. The reasons for shortages often vary. In some cases, a drug maker walks away from a product claiming it is no longer profitable, leaving an insufficient number of alternative suppliers. At times, some manufacturers complain that a regulatory requirement is too costly to pursue and choose to withdraw from a particular market. Last year, however, the U.S. saw 186 new shortages, 82% of which were classified as due to, quote, unknown reasons, largely because of the intentional opacity and secrecy of the upstream supply chain, the researchers wrote. Yikes. Just more things to worry about. Okay, well, that does it for today's show. Sorry I didn't have any non-COVID-19 news. Oh, man. But if you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com, or you can look at the show, previous shows, or queue up future shows by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.